Thumbs up. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our half-year results presentation. I'm delighted to sit in front of you and deliver what I think is another sort of does what it says on the tin set of numbers from One Savings Bank. I'm going to cover some highlights and then talk to you a bit later on around why we're confident in terms of our outlook. And in between that, April will give you a lot more color in terms of the numbers. Firstly, just on those highlights, a good half year in terms of gross organic lending, up 25% on the equivalent period last year. Therefore, loans and advances grew without the impact of our rather cunning Rochester Finance transaction earlier in the year by 10% on a net loans basis. Still, that strong focus on cost control in the business, and despite further investment in new buildings, new infrastructure, significantly enhancing our risk function, and modelling through to help us towards IRB, cost-to-income ratio delivering best-in-class at 27%, all leading to an underlying rise in profit before tax of 36%, up to £64.6 million. And obviously our statutory profit comes in at £100 million because of the gain on that Rochester transaction. Underlying earnings per share up 27%. Return on equity we're particularly pleased with. We all talked about the fact that the new bank surcharge would have a damaging effect in terms of ROE. We still delivered significantly ahead of our stated objective of 25%, 29% for the first half of the year. Had the surtax not been in place, it would have been 31%, so the same as the full year 2015. Because of that Rochester transaction and the profitability in the first half of the year, we find ourselves with an incredibly healthy CET1 ratio, up 2.3% at 13.3%, and we will, of course, be following our usual dividend policy of one-third of last year's dividend as the first dividend at 2.9 pence per share. So those are the highlights. I'll let April give you a little more colour in terms of the numbers.
Okay, thank you, Andy, and good morning, everybody. I'd like to start with an update on our financial objectives. I'm very pleased to say we continue to meet them all comfortably in the first half. We remain predominantly retail funded with a strong loan-to-deposit ratio of 85%, excluding the impact of funding for lending, or 93% including it. We've now drawn down £576 million under the scheme and are aiming for an additional circa £200 million in the second half. Our cost-to-income ratio of 27% in the first half, as Andy said, remains best in class, reflecting our continued focus on cost discipline and efficiency, but has increased slightly, as I previously guided, due to the extra infrastructure and regulatory investments we've made, including the cost of IRB and IFRS 9 modelling. I would expect the full-year ratio to remain broadly in line with the first half, but with continued investment in risk modelling. Our Common Equity Tier 1 ratio, as Andy mentioned, was strengthened significantly by the disposal of our entire economic interest in the Rochester securitisation in late May. This transaction added approximately 1.5 percentage points onto our CET1 ratio as we realised the significant increase in the fair value of the securitised mortgages since we purchased them, a classic case of buy low and sell high. We ended the first half with a strong CET1 ratio of 13.3%, positioning us well for further growth opportunities. Our underlying return on equity for the first half was 29%, significantly in excess of our target, and down only 2% on the prior period, despite the new bank surcharge, which increased our effective tax rate by about 6% in the first half. In line with our dividend policy, we're declaring an interim dividend of 2.9 pence per share, which is formulaically one-third of last year's full-year dividend. Turning to the next slide, here's our usual key financial indicators that show how we achieved our strong return on equity in the first half. I'm really happy with the 36% increase in underlying profit before tax to £65 million, due largely to the growth in the loan book and our strong net interest margin. Net interest margin improved slightly to 307 basis points versus the first half of 2015, despite the drag of prudently increasing liquidity in the run-up to the referendum, reflecting the positive impacts of new organic lending and portfolio acquisitions and a lower cost of funds, which more than offset the remaining impact of the roll-off of our high-yielding personal loan portfolio. The reduction in the Bank of England base rate announced earlier this month is not expected to impact our net interest margin due to rate reductions on administered savings. Since the creation of the bank, we've deliberately kept control of asset pricing in our core businesses, with the majority of new origination linked to our own standard variable rates or in naturally hedged short-term fixed rate products. This control over pricing provides significant protection against further rate cuts. I therefore expect NIM for the full year to be broadly in line with the first half. We'll see a benefit from the excess liquidity being used to fund loan book growth in the third quarter, and we'll see the benefit of the lower prevailing cost of retail funds as our fixed-term savings bonds mature this year and beyond. These two are expected to broadly offset the impact of the disposal of the higher-yielding mortgages in the Rochester securitisation in the second half. The MPC also announced a new term funding scheme. This is 25 basis points cheaper than the funding for lending scheme, as it's in the form of a cash repo. But we want to maximise our FLS drawdown before the allowance reduces at the end of January. The bottom right-hand chart shows our efficiency metrics and this shows the increase in MANEX, the ratio of operating cost to total assets due to the investments made in infrastructure and regulation that I mentioned earlier. The next slide shows the comparison of our P&L for the first half 2016 versus the same period last year. I'll just pick out a few points here. Firstly, the FSCS provision, which represents a full year's worth of levies, which are recognised 1st of April each year. It's significantly lower than the prior year due to the FSCS's announcement that does not expect to collect contributions in respect of capital loan repayments this year. There's also a small reduction in our accrual from last year's levy based on their latest estimates. Turning to impairments, I'm very pleased with the improved loan loss ratio of 18 basis points despite prudently increasing assumptions in our collective provision models post-Brexit. This improvement reflects the continued strong performance from the front book with continued very low arrears and loan losses. From more than 25,000 loans totalling £5 billion organically originated since the bank's creation, we still only have 71 cases 3 months or more in arrears at the half year, with a total value of just £10.5 million and an average loan-to-value of 66%. Current portfolio arrears rates remain strong, very slightly improved on June. However, we will continue to take a prudent approach in our collective provision assumptions informed by market and macroeconomic conditions. Andy mentioned the exceptional gain from our disposal of our economic interest in the Rochester securitisation of £34.7 million earlier. Just to let you know, we're now reporting costs associated with our IPO awards in OPEX rather than continuing to show them as exceptional expenses given the small remaining size as the majority of those awards have now vested fully. Exceptional income expenses not subject to dividend. The significant increase in our effective tax rate you can see here is obviously due to the Bank Corporation Tax Surcharge. And finally on this slide, I'm very pleased with the 4.2 pence improvement in underlying earnings per share, reflecting the overall growth in profitability, which more than offset the impact of the surcharge. Turning to the balance sheet. Showed 5% growth in our loan book in the first half. Underlying loan book growth, excluding the impact of the Rochester sale at the end of the period, was 10%, reflecting strong organic origination, which is up 25% on the same period last year, and £131 million worth of portfolio purchases in the first half. These obviously were partially offset by attrition in our back book and acquired portfolios in runoff. Current application levels in our core products are significantly higher than the average for the first half, supporting the delivery of full-year net loan book growth in line with our previous guidance of marginally above 20%. However, this now excludes the impact of the Rochester disposal. Given current uncertainty, we are taking a more cautious approach to lending in some of our smaller, more cyclical funding line and residential development businesses, and also when assessing portfolio purchases. However, we do see potential upside opportunities supported by a strong capital position for further accretive portfolio acquisitions given reduced competition in this area, subject, of course, to us establishing the correct risk versus reward pricing for any such acquisitions. First half loan book growth was funded in part by additional drawdowns from the FLS, with the balance funded by retail savings deposits. Just as a reminder, the FLS drawdowns, which are held off balance sheets as they're in the form of T-bills, do form part of our liquidity portfolio and enable us to utilise other cash deposits to fund loan book growth. The liquidity ratio you can see here reflects the additional liquidity we prudently drew down in the run-up to the EU referendum. Since the referendum, we have not seen any unusual behaviour amongst savers, and therefore we are utilising that liquidity to fund loan book growth in the third quarter. Turning to our segments, the buy-to-let SME segment experienced strong net loan book growth in the first half of 14%, driven by £800 million of new organic origination, which is up 24% versus the same period last year. This new lending, together with the falling cost of funds, drove the significant increase you can see in net interest income, which is up 48%. This chart also shows you our stable gross asset yields before swaps. The growth in net interest income drove the 64% increase in contribution to profit from this segment to £59.9 million, which was also helped by the significant reduced loan loss ratio, just 4 basis points on an annualised basis in this segment, reflecting the negligible 3 month plus arrears in our front book. Average loan to values remained good, low at 68% at the end of June, with only 1% of loans by value with the loan to values exceeding 90%. The next slide shows you a further breakdown of our loan book, our gross loan book in this segment by sub-segments, new disclosure, which we hope you'll find useful. Again, this shows a strong 15% growth in the buy-to-let sub-segment in the first half. Average interest rate coverage on new buy-to-let origination in the first half was strong at 161%, demonstrating our cautious approach to assessing customer affordability. The proportion of new purchase applications coming from limited companies increased to 58% in June versus 40% in December as professional landlords, our target market, continue to respond to the forthcoming tax changes on interest deductions. You can see here our exposure to commercial real estate, which is limited, with a semi-commercial gross loan book of £249 million at the end of June, but with a weighted average loan to value of just 56%. And an average loan size of £265,000. Our approved credit limits on secured funding lines to non-bank lenders in this segment grew in the first half to £190 million, with loans outstanding of £61 million. The pipeline remains strong post-Brexit, but we have tightened criteria on loan-to-value and loan size in the more cyclical product lines. Our residential development finance business continued to gain momentum in the first half with total committed funding of £182 million at the end of the period. We continue to run stringent stress tests for both the value and timing of sales and build costs, which may reduce the number of schemes that pass these tests post-Brexit until the medium to long-term outlook becomes clearer. Turning to the next slide in our residential loan book, this shrank in the first half due to the Rochester disposal at the end of the period, which more than offset the impact of new origination. However, we had £173 million of new organic origination in this segment, which is up 28% on the prior year. We also had portfolio purchases of £131 million in the first half. The percentage of new residential loans written with loan-to-income ratios above 4.5 times more than halved in the first half to just 1.5%, well below the regulatory cap of 15%, reflecting our stringent affordability testing. Net interest income of £36.3 million was up 11%, with stable asset yields and a lower cost of funds. However, contribution to profit was broadly flat due to higher impairment charges after the additional prudency we took in collective provision models post-Brexit, which mainly impacted the acquired portfolios with arrears at the point of purchase in this segment. Average loan-to-values remain low at 57%, with just 2% of loans by value, with LTVs exceeding 90%. The next slide, again, gives you a little bit more breakdown of that gross loan book by sub-segment. In first charge residential, you can see the impact of the Rochester disposal, which was £220 million worth of mortgage assets. That sub-segment ended the first half at $1.3 billion. The second charge loan book remained broadly flat, with new organic lending and portfolio purchases offset by redemptions on the organic book and the acquired portfolios in runoff. We continue to provide uncommitted secured funding lines in this segment to non-bank lenders, ending the first half with total credit approved limits of $78 million and total loans outstanding of $62 million. Consistent with funding lines in our buy-to-let SME segment, we have tightened our criteria post-Brexit. The next slide gives into a little bit more detail about the strength of our balance sheet. I'm starting with capital. You can see the strengthening capital ratios post the Rochester disposal and our first half profitability. As I've mentioned before, CET1 at 13.3%, total capital at 15.6%, and our leverage ratio very strong at 5.3%, all significantly ahead of end-game regulatory requirements. On the credit risk side, our weighted average total loan book loan-to-value is 62%. New origination in the first half was 72%. We have limited exposure to expensive properties, with less than 2% of our loan book secured on properties valued at greater than £2 million and with LTVs above 65%. These sensible loan-to-values are complemented by our stable portfolio arrears rate of 2.1%, excluding our legacy problem loan books. The legacy problem loan book inherited from the Building Society is heavily provisioned and has been further reduced in the first half to just £15.8 million. Our strong balance sheet positions us well to take advantage of our organic and accretive inorganic growth opportunities going forward. So the next slide, I just want to finish by giving you a summary of the full-year guidance I've outlined as I've gone through my remarks. So starting with growth, applications in our core businesses in the second half to date significantly higher than the first half run rate. However, we are taking a cautious approach in our smaller, more cyclical businesses and when assessing portfolio purchases, given the uncertain outlook. We are guiding for full-year loan book growth as marginally higher than 20%, but excluding the impact of Rochester as we take a more cautious approach to replacing those assets. So just to be clear, this means you take the 2015 year-end loan book, multiply by marginally more than 20%, and remove $220 million of Rochester mortgages. However, we do see upside, potentially, supported by a strong capital position for accretive portfolio acquisitions given reduced competition in this area, subject to us establishing the correct risk versus reward pricing for any such purchases. We expect full-year NIM to be broadly in line with the first half, as the benefit of using our excess liquidity to fund loan book growth and the benefit of fixed-term retail deposits maturing onto lower prevailing rates are offset by the loss of the high-yielding Rochester mortgages we sold in May. We expect full-year cost-to-income ratio to be broadly in line with the first half, with some further investments still to come in the regulatory arena. Portfolio arrears are stable, in fact, very slightly improved so far in the third quarter. We will continue to prudently assess our collective provision assumptions in line with market and macroeconomic conditions. I'll now pass on to Andy, who'll give you an update on our strategic developments in the business and the outlook.
Thank you. I'm not going to talk to you for too long about the sort of two halves of our franchise, but I am going to touch on some of the key points. Strong organic originations, as you've heard, a good uplift in lending through particularly buy-to-let in the first half of 16 versus the first half of 15. Our sort of performance in terms of credit remains exceptionally strong since we sort of kicked the bank back into life post the change from the Building Society into One Savings Bank. We've written more than 25,000 loans, and we still have only 71 of those in three-month-plus arrears. It's not worth putting on a graph because it doesn't really show much unless you fiddle with the scale beyond all recognition, but that, we think, is a real accolade to the strength of our underwriting and our initial proposition. April talked about limited company and the focus on professional landlords. That focus is absolutely starting to pay dividend. Limited company buy-to-let applications are 58% at the June period versus 40% at the end of 2015. And professional landlords accounted for 72% of all of our completions during the first half versus 69% in the first half of 2015. All of our brands are performing. Refinancing continues to be key. 60% of what we do is refinance. We see further opportunities for that. We're shortly going to be launching to the market a fees-free remortgage package for even portfolio landlords to come and bring their portfolios to us, and we think that'll be quite a unique offering in the marketplace. And as I always do, one or two shameless plugs. Yes, we win Best Buy-to-Let Lender a lot, but I'm super delighted that in 2016 we also won Best Specialist Lender at the What Mortgage Awards, which is the broker and borrowing community really stating that the Kent Reliance, the Interbay, and other brands under the One Savings umbrella really do understand their niches and their specialist markets, and we're delighted with that. In terms of the funding franchise, it remains incredibly stable, very loyal customers, very sticky balances, and growing. Another 1.1 billion of retail balances joined us during the first half of the year, 16,000 new customers, and increasingly our online offering is becoming popular with both new and existing customers. And later this year, we'll also be launching an online savings offering into the small business and corporate community, which again we think will be very beneficial in terms of cost of funds, but also provides businesses with perhaps a slightly more remunerative home for their excess cash than the big high street banks, some of whom have talked about starting to charge them to hold their balances post the base rate reduction. We continue to focus on the service proposition, on retention, on trying to get it right, on doing the right thing for the customer in terms of our proposition. And our net promoter score for the first half of 2016 at 59%, that's absolutely best in class in terms of a bank net promoter score. We're very, very proud of that. Recognition, we get lots of it. Fourth year running, best cash ISA provider, another one that we're quite proud of. Another shameless plug, of course. Second year running, best bank savings provider. I'm particularly proud of that one, too. It's been a few years since we won Best Building Society, although while we were a bank, we did win that, which I thought was quite amusing. But I'm delighted that, again, we've won the best bank savings provider. And then in terms of the prudency of our funding, as I said, we have a very loyal and sticky customer base. April mentioned that we did take in more retail funding and draw more under FLS pre-Brexit in case there was any sort of economic shock in terms of customers not knowing what to do with their money. We didn't see any change in customer behaviour, and as April said, we'll now use that excess funding to fund our growth through Q3 and Q4 this year, but we thought it was appropriate to be prudent. And we still, of course, have access to some more drawings under the FLS, and now with the new term funding scheme coming on board, 25 basis points, what's not to like, so we will be making use of that scheme as well. I'll summarise briefly and then I'll touch on outlook. First half of 2016, very strong for us. Good growth, delivering on all of the objectives we set at IPO and delivering what I think is an excellent return on equity, even given that additional bank surtax. Strong originations, application run rate for the second half of the year is significantly higher than that which we saw in the first half, which gives us confidence in terms of that forward-looking outlook. And we've increased our capital ratio significantly. Not only does that help in terms of providing us with buffers, but it also gives us capital to make use of if we find an acquisition opportunity, and we believe more of those may be coming down the pipe that we like the risk and reward dynamic on. We've enhanced the proposition for professional landlords, and that's paying dividend. We have tightened criteria on some of those businesses which are more reliant on liquidity in UK property stock, such as development finance, for example. And we continue with low impairment levels, micro arrears on the front book, and stringent stress testing. I can't say that, stringent stress testing. In rehearsal, we both got it wrong. April got it right earlier, and I definitely can't say it because I've got it wrong three times now. But we focus on stress testing, and our book stress tests incredibly well. So in terms of outlook, we're not going to sort of pump guidance out for the next 5 years because we are in some degree of uncertainty in terms of comment. But our confidence in the core buy-to-let market remains very strong. We work closely with Lazarus, the economic forecasting house, to understand household cash flow, understand rental demand, and what might happen in terms of the housing market. And we're confident that there are more heads than there are roofs, and people therefore require roof overhead, and increasingly the private rented sector, particularly if buying property becomes less favourable, will be the place people turn to provide that. And we're very happy to keep financing that market because we think it's an intrinsic part of the UK economy and the UK housing market. In 2017, because of what we're seeing in terms of our pipeline and application volumes, because of what we're hearing from brokers and our larger borrowers, we believe we'll continue to deliver double-digit growth through organic lending. I can't put exactly a number on that yet because it does depend to some extent what happens in terms of the economy, but we're confident that growth will come through our organic lending in 2017. And as April mentioned, we do see further upside opportunity in terms of acquisitions. Clearly, we'll be tougher in terms of price negotiation, but with that capital ratio behind us now, I think it gives us a really strong opportunity to look into that sweet spot where we've always been good on acquisition, slightly less than 250, 300 million, where it's too small to securitize. You know, there's not that many banks around now, that non-bank lenders, sorry, that are able to find the funding to do these kind of transactions, and we think that gives us an advantage in terms of price negotiation. And we have a very strong track record in delivery, and buyer and sellers really like that if the buyer has a strong track record. So we do see further opportunities in that space over the next 18 months. And therefore, we think our strong business model, a highly efficient cost base, our strong customer regard and broker regard in terms of net promoter score, and the fact that we are increasingly becoming the go-to lender in those specialist niches in which we trade, mean we believe we're well positioned for growth in 2017. So at that point, we will end, and we'd love to throw open to the floor for questions and answers. There is a lady at the back with a microphone, so we can make sure everyone can hear the questions. Ian's hand is first up.
Morning, Ian Gordon, Investec. Can I have three, please? On NIM, when April listed the pluses and minuses, I distinctly heard benefit from lower retail costs offset by Rochester disposal and personal loan runoff. I didn't hear you reference TFS in that stable NIM guidance, as I did hear Andy refer to your intention to use TFS. So could I just push you a bit further to talk about, do you see TFS as potential upside to NIM guidance, especially given the fact that the market thinks the cost of TFS will be below 25 bps?
I do. I think it's just about timing. FLS is still very inexpensive funding, which lasts for 4 years. Your ability to borrow transitions down in January. So I do want to maximise that four-year funding and then draw down on TFS. I think we're still waiting for sort of the I's to be dotted and the T's to be crossed when it comes to the term, you know, the haircuts, how much you can borrow. So yes, I certainly do intend to draw down on that. You may see more of that benefit coming in 2017 than 2016 though.
Thank you. The second one is just a simple one. Listening to your slightly more cautious guidance on your appetite in certain product segments, it feels like your net flow will be closer to 100% coming from buy-to-let. Is that a fair representation?
I think buy-to-let will be the rump of the business we do. We'll still trade in that bespoke residential space. The second charge market's small, but we'll do our share. We're happy with the share we're doing in that market. Actually, you know, we're still actively growing in the development finance arena. We're just being a bit tougher about the sort of schemes we look at. One of the ways in which we stress test the scheme is that we obviously have the build cost that the builder thinks they're going to use. We have those checked by a proper QS, and then we inflate the build cost. So if there's overrun and they find it hard to get labour, etc., and we inflate them in a magnitude, and then we do the comps on the valuation and look at sales price, and we deflate the sales price. And what we look for is where those two things get into the red quadrant on our sort of matrix. We want the developer to make a healthy profit, because that's the developer's incentive to still continue to work the development through. If it shows a very marginal profit, then that's not the kind of scheme we're interested in. We'll let the other people finance that. So we're just being a little bit more conservative, but I don't think that means we won't grow. We've always said that development finance book will get to about 250 million and revolve. It's getting to that sort of magnitude as we move forward, and that's where we want it to be, just with a slightly tighter criteria set around it. And you had a third one.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, and the third one, just I think your broad guidance on organic growth points to quite material upgrades to current measurable consensus expectations. But even doing the maths for that, it still seems to leave a really quite material surplus capital position. Now, I know you talked about increasing optionality for inorganic acquisitions, something consensus seems to give you zero credit for in valuation until it happens. But can you just talk about how you see the balance between keeping your powder dry for potential acquisitions and potentially paying out the surplus, given that your target guidance is 25% or greater distribution?
It is. Thank you for that question. That's a really good question. I mean, look, at the moment, I think over the next 18 months there are going to be plenty of opportunities to deploy that capital and deploy it at a price which is really strongly ROE accretive. At the point when that stops, or if that stops, then clearly we'll think about dividend policy. But at the moment, that's not central to our plan. Our plan is within the tolerances and the buffers that the board want to run to, we'll deploy capital into organic. But also when you can do an acquisition, you can do mortgages one at a time, or you can do them a few hundred thousand at a time. If we see the right risk and reward dynamic, we're in a position to swoop, and that's key. Thank you. There was one there, and then Gary, I'll come back to you. I can see that almost. Hi.
Hi there, good morning. I think I hijacked it there, sorry. Daniel Garrett, Barclays, a couple from me. Firstly, I wonder if you can comment, you're clearly highlighting applications picking up in H2. What sort of factors would you attribute to that much stronger H2 environment? And is it against an average of H1? Because presumably March was the exception. There was strong applications accelerating into that particular month. So just any more clarity around what's contributing to that. And secondly, what does that mean in terms of sort of application to originations? Is there any change in conversion there? Ask a question, because when you look at your progression, Q2 originations versus Q1, Q2 was obviously quite a lot slower, but it was for the whole of the industry. So, do you anticipate pick up in the Q3, Q4 originations relative to that Q2? Thank you.
Thanks. I mean, both good questions, Dan. I mean, let's talk about why we think app volumes are increasing for us versus H1. I mean, March wasn't actually an application spike. It was a completion spike. And a lot of the spike was people pulling forward natural completions that perhaps would have happened in April or May, obviously beating their solicitor very hard to try and get stuff done before that stamp element kicked in. And there's no doubt that from an application perspective, all brokers did in the sort of 3 weeks during March was chase their pipeline through, because that's what their existing customers wanted them to do. And therefore, apps really fell off a cliff for the whole industry during the month of April. We saw them normalize back up to sort of usual run rates during May. From June, July, and through August, we've seen a significant uptick. And we have done some internal thinking and talking to brokers around why are we seeing the uptick? And we're getting a lot of positive feedback around, well, you guys know what you're doing. You're targeting the portfolio guys. You're making it not easy, because not from a credit perspective, but operationally we make it easy for a landlord to move a portfolio from one lender to another. We understand the marketplace. We go and meet borrowers with large portfolios. An underwriter actually goes out and sees them, looks at some of the stock, etc. So you start to build a relationship, and increasingly your existing customers with portfolios coming up for renewal elsewhere will tell their broker they want it placed with us, and we're hearing that from our broker community. So I think some of it is just a continuing build of the franchise that we've been doing over the last 3 or 4 years. I think there are one or two non-bank lenders who clearly have lost their funding lines post-Brexit. We've seen a withdrawal of activity from people like sort of the Northview Group and so on, who haven't necessarily got the retail funding lines that some of us have. And I think that will probably take a little bit of capacity out of the market. I think it's a little bit of the market's still going, it's still buoyant. It didn't stop post the stamp duty changes, which a lot of people thought it might. We're talking to portfolio borrowers who are still acquiring. We're doing a lot of refinance business, as I've touched on. And I think we know what we're doing in that space, and we're hearing that from the broker and the distribution community. So that's helping. But run rate is the average weekly applications for the second half of the year so far, they are significantly up on the average weekly applications for the first half. So we're feeling pretty good and pretty sanguine about that. In terms of conversion, actually, we're improving some of our conversion rates. We've done some work, for example, in our interbank business, where we used to have a bit of a broker throw it over the fence, we'd have a look at it and toss it back if we didn't like it piece. We've trained our BDMs more so that they're out having conversations with brokers saying, well, hang on a minute, we can't do it in that way, but if you structured the deal like this, or if you looked at the deal in a different way, or perhaps at this LTV. So we're having our sales force do a lot more of that sort of structuring and pre-qualification. So what's coming in from the broker is therefore a much better package deal, and that enables the underwriter to get straight on with looking at the security and looking at the borrower and understanding the proposition. and that's helping us in terms of conversion rates. So we expect to see, from our perspective, an improvement in our conversion from application through to eventual completion. Actually, our conversion rates are pretty good already, but if we can improve it, then that's all good at the end of the day.
Thank you.
Thanks. And then Gary, who's next, I think.
Thanks. It's Gary at Shore Capital. I've got two questions. One is just following up on Ian's question about capital deployment and acquisitions. I was just wondering how you think about your own shares in the arena of acquisitions and whether you would consider buying them back given where they're trading at the moment. And then the second question is on collective provisions. Obviously, you say you've increased your collective provision. We heard from Aldermore the other week. They'd increase their collective provision. I think they'd push their emergence periods out from 9 to 12 months. So just wondering how your assumptions compare in that respect and what flexibility you have under IFRS to book further forward in terms of collective provisions, because I know it's quite restrictive.
Sure. Okay. I'll handle collective one to you, and I'll talk about capital deployment and share purchases. I mean, the only thing we've thought about so far is buying some stock to fund share purchase schemes, etc., for staff and so forth, and having a pool of stock to do that with. We haven't had any debate at board level around would we consider or are we interested in buying our own stock, and it wouldn't be appropriate of me to give you any answer really to that question, as it's not a matter the board have debated. I think it's an interesting question, and as a function of that, I'll raise it at the next board meeting, and if there's anything material that comes from that, we can communicate that. But it isn't something that's been on the table for discussion. I'm much more interested in leveraging OSB paper for acquisitions and transactions and potentially some bigger things than just mortgage portfolios, but that's a story for another day, perhaps. And now someone's going to ask me the question, so I get to tell it.
But I'll move on to the collective provision question. There's obviously always a lot of subjective decisions to make in your collective provisioning models. I think, in common with others in the industry, when you look forward to 2018 and IFRS 9, and in an uncertain economic outlook, we're certainly seeking to take a more prudent view on some of those assumptions, which is what you saw in the half year. And we'll do the same at the year end when we look at what the market conditions and macroeconomic conditions and outlook look like there. But you're also quite right. I mean, you have to find the right balance. I'm sure our auditors would make us do that even if we didn't. It has to be an acceptable level of assumptions. You have to be able to back those up as well within the standards.
So does that allow you to sort of smooth the transition to IFRS 9?
I mean, it's a very different model with a kind of moving from a sort of 12-month loss outlook to lifetime losses. So I wouldn't necessarily talk about smoothing it. As I say, I think in this economic environment post-Brexit, I think you'll find most people should be, going a little bit further down the prudent line when assessing these assumptions, and that's exactly what we've done.
Thank you.
Peter.
Good morning. It's Peter Lonardos from RBC. Two questions, please. First, could you please comment on cost development going forward? When should we expect the rate of cost increases to start to normalize? And the second, if you could comment on the reasoning for the large increase in the residential loan losses.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, I'll take the second one first because I think it continues. I mean, our arrears have been very stable, so that really is almost entirely due to the changes in assumptions that I just described. And then on cost increases, I mean, I think there's probably, the cost of regulation, I think is probably something that isn't going to finish next year. We'll continue to have to invest in that as we grow our business and as, regulation unfolds. But in the medium term, I would hope to see some economies of scale benefits. We continue to look for ways to utilize our very efficient cost-effective Indian back office. So we're continually looking at more commoditized processing that we can pass on to that team, which they do extremely well. So I think some economies of scale in the medium term, the investment we've made in some of our sort of core processing systems, I think in the medium term will start to pay dividends. But I don't underestimate the the time period where we will need to continue to invest in our compliance, our risk functions. I think it's just something we, yeah, cost of being a regulated bank.
Thank you.
Yes. Hi.
Mike's on his way.
Morning. Aaron Milmani from Macquarie. I have three. If you could just take it in turns. When I look at sort of house prices, and I wondered just where are you writing the gross yield for your mortgages, and how's that, I mean, if you're not able to give a number, how's that changed over the last 1 to 2 years? That would be one. Two would be, would you be able to comment on the pace of backbook redemptions? How's that changed, if it has at all? And lastly, I think if you just give me the number for, in terms of buy-to-let, what is the percentage of remortgaging that you're writing as opposed to sort of new buy-to-lets?
I'll pick off the buy-to-let one first because it's actually in the presentation deck. It's about 60% of what we write is refinance, 40% is new purchase. I'll come back to the first point, which is asset yield.
From history.
And then, I don't know what number it is. And then I'll ask her to talk to you about the redemptions and our choices program. I mean, in terms of if, when you say gross yield, do you mean the asset yield we're earning?
Not you. When you look at the mortgage, what is the landlord earning, and how's that changed in terms of?
Okay. So I mean, clearly in the more expensive areas, the yields have been falling, although rent has been increasing faster than inflation. So that's done something to accommodate for that. The knock-on effect of that is it becomes a relatively lender-protecting, self-fulfilling prophecy. If you want to do a buy-to-let in Chatham, where our head office is, I have a couple in Chatham, actually you can get about a 5.1% yield on nice stock let to a professional couple. You can get a higher yield on different stock let to a different tenant. It depends on what, as a landlord, your tenant profile matches. If you go Notting Hill, you know, you're going to be lucky to yield 3%. And therefore, when we want to stress the interest rate cover, and we want to stress it for interest rate rises, and we want to bake in into that maintenance costs and everything else, you're going to struggle to get anything more than a 50% loan-to-value mortgage. So it kind of has a dampening effect in terms of LTVs. So what we don't actually look at the yield on the property per se. We do. We understand it as part of the valuation metric. What we look at is the percentage of interest rate coverage over and above the mortgage payment, less our stress and our sort of maintenance costs. And that's 161% is the number that April gave for the first half of the year.
Is the 161 on a stressed?
Stress.
That's the 5.5%.
Not 5.5. We're a bit more complicated in the way we do that. Some are higher than that. Some are slightly lower, but it's quite a detailed stress. Some of what we do in terms of property holding costs, etc., is actually exactly what's in the PRA consultation paper. So we have quite a scientific methodology of stress. We're not just a blunt instrument stress. And April, do you want to talk about redemptions?
Yeah, redemptions. So, I mean, this is something that we're very focused on as a strategy. As we've been growing the business and growing our origination since we were created, as we mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of our products are discount to our SVR or they're naturally hedged six. A lot of that's 2-3 year products. So every year we get a bigger volume of mortgages going into our choices program where they get to the end of that product term. I don't think there's been any unusual behavior in that regard or any change. What we're seeking to do is up the retention rate by launching, I think, quite an innovative broker-led choices program, I think the first in the market. We launched that in July. And that's really to improve the engagement of our borrowers as we get to the end of that product term. So far too soon for me to say anything about how that's going, but that is something that we're looking very closely at strategically. You know, just as our proposition to our savers on the savings products is that, you know, we want to encourage loyalty and we want to have high retention, we have exactly the same philosophy when it comes to our borrowers. You know, better to retain a borrower than it is to replace with a new one. So that is a real focus for us, but sort of too soon for me to really give any comments on how that broker-led choices program may impact retention.
I mean, have you disclosed what your retention number is in the past? Or?
No, we haven't.
One at the back.
Good morning. It's David Morgan, Credit Suisse. Two questions, if I may. The first one is just the cost, just another question on the cost, because in the past, you were very consistent about maintaining the management expense ratio at 77 basis points, so it's picked up to 82 basis points. Is that sort of a reasonable run rate to extrapolate, basically, is my first question. And just on that, because you mentioned that these costs pertain largely to the regulatory, are they, do they pertain just to IFRS 9 implementation and IRB implementation, or there's more general costs involved in, you know, upgrading risk and controls? That's the sort of first large question. The second one is just, as we head into April 2017, that's when the tax changes on budget-led mortgages kick in. Have you any updates to share with us on, you know, how you're thinking your landlord customers will respond to that? Thank you.
Good question. Well, should I take the cost one first? I think I heard fairly regularly signaled over the last few years that our manics and cost to income is likely to trend up a little bit due to the expected cost of meeting regulation of IRB models of IFRS 9. But we would always look for ways to offset that through greater efficiencies elsewhere. So this is, you know, I think we're now seeing as we really accelerate our efforts towards growing our risk function, growing our compliance function, building these models, that's why you've seen the uptick. So I think, you know, in the short term, expect that to continue. Medium term, as I think I mentioned earlier, you know, we will continue to look for other efficiencies to offset that. But I think, yes, that is a, you know, a long signal finally arrived uptick in our manics ratio. And I think in the shorter term, you should continue to see it at that sort of level. And as I said, more still for us to do over the next 6 to 12 months on that model building as well.
And then coming on to the April 17 tax changes, obviously that's when they start kicking in. They're sort of phased in up through to 2020. I mean, I think the big thing is that there are still a lot of people at the amateur end of the market who haven't really woken up to the fact these tax changes are coming yet. Fortunately, that's not our target market. We did do a piece of thought leadership with Ernst & Young that we published out to the whole broking community and to larger buy-to-let borrowers talking about the impact of the tax changes and how people should be thinking. But I think the key is to make sure that you're working with brokers who understand the differences between doing something as an SPV or an LLP versus doing it in your own name as a basic or even high, you know, basic high rate or super rate taxpayer. And we're trying to drive the thought leadership on that, and that's yielding results because the tick up in the number of people buying in a limited company structure has been quite marked, and I think it will continue. Actually, we've also seen some people selling property out of their own name, crystallizing the stamp. You can offset the capital gain, but crystallizing the stamp duty, that's an opportunity for us because that's an extra sort of few percent we can lend on top, and then selling back into an SPV and off, you know, that stamp eventually is a deductible cost when you liquidate, and they're just taking and accepting that timing difference. And I think we will see a little bit more of that, particularly for those people that have got portfolios that are fairly extensive in their private name, and we see that as an opportunity. And if we understand it and we have the mechanics and we perhaps even provide an SPV in a box to make it very easy to do that, and we are talking to various firms about how we might go about that, I think we can capitalize on that opportunity. But we are seeing a borrower behavior change, and I think it's good that we are. Sorry, there's one there, and then we will open up to the phones to see if there are questions on phones. Let's take one more from the room first.
Two questions, if I may. The first is on competition. Can you give us a little more detail about the current competitive background and also how you think competition may change going forward given the outcome of the referendum? And the second question, just a brief update. Is there anything new on IRB and how that is going with regards to one savings? Thank you.
Sure. So if I tackle competition, and then you can do the hard stuff. The competition arena, you know, there are definitely banks out there that trade in our space. You know, we come across the same names when we're looking at portfolios. We get to see a whole asset and liability statement for all of our portfolio borrowers, so I know they've got a bit of power in them, perhaps a bit here and a bit there. Actually, I wouldn't say there's any one standout competitor that we find ourselves, you know, sort of squeaking on price with, etc. I still don't see the big banks getting the professional landlord market and coming back into it. I mean, I was ribbing some friends from Barclays yesterday about the fact you can get a buy-to-let mortgage from Barclays for, you know, 1.7% or something ridiculous, whereas, you know, our cheapest one's in the mid-threes with a chunky fee on it. And somebody said, well, how come Barclays can do it this cheap? Well, Barclays can do it that cheap, but you have to be a dinner party landlord, i.e. it's only on one property. It's maxed out 50% loan to value. You've got to, you know, give them your inside leg measurement and deposit 10 billion of gold bullion with them to get, you know, the conditions around it mean it's just targeted at a borrower who doesn't know what they're doing. And therefore, you know, we're not seeing a shift in the big banks trying to come back into or play in that space. When they did, they weren't very good at it, to be fair. That's why I'm not interested in buying Bradford and Bingley portfolios. Perhaps I shouldn't say that publicly. So the competition dynamic, I think, you know, our genuine peer competitors will continue to grow in the market. I think the market will continue to grow. You know, our forecasters tell us that buy-to-let is likely to grow, you know, somewhere like 10% per annum in terms of demand and overall lending volume. That's, you know, that's quite a big market, and we're still a relatively small slice of it, so there's more we can go at. Our view is, look, you know, develop the proposition, keep on it with your distributors. I mean, April talked about our choices program. To go, brokers in the old days used to rape lenders, and lenders used to rape brokers. So, you know, they dot customers around everywhere because they were just trying to earn the prop fee and place the deal, and lenders would try and steal the customer at the end of the term and lock them in so the broker didn't get another prop fee. That's not a way to do business in partnership. Our choices program, working with our key distributors, saying, look, you know, when they come to the end of the term, if we've got something good, we'll pay you to put the customer back with us, but do the right job for the borrower. That's us working in partnership. So enhancing your proposition in that way, focusing on your efficiency, understanding your market and being good at it, that's the kind of stuff that locks out competition, and that's what we'll continue to try and do.
Okay, so IRB, and I think as we've mentioned before, you know, we were early to lock in external resources to help with our model building. We were thoughtful about building our risk team in plenty of time because, you know, I think there is going to be a scarcity of resources for those that are a little bit behind the curve on the timing of these projects. And the project is going well and is currently on track. I think we'd previously announced that we were expecting kind of the first generation IRB models and IFRS 9 to be delivered later this year. We're still on track for that. The aim is to have a full year of parallel run in 2017 with the IFRS 9 models. I think, as I've mentioned before, it's the same thing. You know, what we're doing is we're putting those two projects together. IFRS 9 models will be the first run of IRB as well. So we'll give further update in our prelims. And, you know, at some stage next year, we'll be able to give some guidance on the impact of IFRS 9. But we want a good period of sort of correlating those models before we do so.
Okay, thank you. Can we ask the operator if there are any questions from the phones?
There are currently no questions, but again, as a reminder to ask a question, please press star one. There are no questions from the telephone.
No. Okay, I think we have time for one more from the room if there are any more. If I see no hands, we shall say thank you very much. I see no hands.
Okay.
Thank you very much
thank
for
you,
coming along. And as always, we're available if you need further information. So nice to see you all. Thank you.
Thank you.